The Western novel is an American literary tradition, and our in-depth guest today, John Larrison, has written one of the best ones in recent memory. Whiskey When We're Dry tells the story of teenage Jessalyn Harney, who, when her father dies in the spring of 1885, dresses up like a man and sets out to find her brother Noah, a notorious bank robber with a bounty on his head. John is both a duck and a beaver, earning his undergrad degree from the University of Oregon and his MFA from Oregon State University. During the 8 years it took to write Whiskey When We're Dry, he worked as a fly fishing guide, a college writing instructor, and a freelance contributor to outdoor magazines. John was born in Oregon, but spent much of his childhood in remote regions of Australia, the Caribbean, Canada, the South Pacific, Alaska, and the American West, before graduating from high school in Ithaca, New York. Whiskey When We're Dry, published just 2 weeks ago by Viking Press, is John's third novel. We're fortunate to have him in our studios now to talk about the book. John, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
John, I mentioned in the intro that you grew up seemingly all over the place. So Australia, the Caribbean, Canada, South Pacific, Alaska, U.S. and the American West. What were the reasons for all those moves?
They weren't actually moves. They were prolonged stays. My folks made films for National Geographic for about 20 years. And so in the summer months, my brother and I would accompany them to these places that they were traveling. And that actually led to me, you know, getting into fishing, because we'd travel to these places and we didn't often speak the same language as people. But my brother and I had grown up fishing here in Oregon. And when we would arrive in these places and we'd see kids our age fishing, we could make friends even when we didn't know the same language, you know, because we found fishing to be exciting. So that became this sort of like cross-cultural currency. And that also led to my interest in writing and it all sort of grows out of those early moving.
It's probably not a bad point to mention your first three books all had fishing as a focus. One of them was actually a how-to on fly fishing, and then two novels with kind of fishing as a main plot point.
That's right. Yep. My first book, how I learned to write was writing a how-to book on fly fishing for steelhead in Oregon. But my real passion had always been fiction, and I knew I wanted to learn to write fiction. Fiction's a pretty hard form to learn, and it's I think it's good to start out with something nonfiction that you know a lot about. Yeah,
just to get the writing juices flowing.
That's right. Yep.
Well, I'd have to say you're from reading the book, you're at an expert stage, in my opinion. I do a lot of reading over the course of a year, mainly for the KBOO interviews for In Depth and also for Between the Covers. And I've always admired what I would call drop dead first lines. So examples, Call Me Ishmael, Alpinchin's Screaming Come Across the Sky, Orwell's It Was a Bright Cold Day in April and the Clocks Were Striking 13. That's 1984, of course.
Yes.
I think your book has a drop dead first paragraph. I wonder, would you read that for us?
Oh, I'd love to. So I should say that these words appeared in my ear one night when I was walking, and I rushed home and started writing them.
Actually, as they are on the page?
As
kind
they
of
are
verbatim?
On the page.
Amazing.
Yep. Yes.
What a gift.
That's how it felt, like a very bizarre experience at the time. It was literally a voice in my head. But I knew that was the thing I'd been waiting for, you know, for 10 years of trying to learn to write fiction, was to hear a voice. And this is what I heard. I heard it said, God moves on the water. Well, I have looked for him there. My thirst grows with his flood.
Oh, that was beautiful. And it amazes me, because as you read the book, really a lot of the themes are in there so concisely. And without giving too much away, the very ending of the book reflects back on some of the themes that are in there, with some of the terminology, in fact, too. So that was a very clear signal to you to start the book with those words?
Yes, you know, when I heard those words, I felt a whole novel's worth of tension and sort of intellectual curiosity.
Yes, there's a lot of mystery there you want to read on.
And that's how it felt to me, too. So when I heard those words, I thought, wow, there's a whole book right there. And sort of exploring the tensions and the contradictions within that paragraph. Yeah.
Now, more on that voice. The book, I should mention to readers, listeners, is narrated in the first person by the main character, and I mentioned her. She's 17 years old. Her name's Jessalyn Harney. She goes by Jess, and later in the book, she goes by Jessie. And there's a reason for that, because she dresses up as a boy and pretends to be a man. She sets out west to find her outlaw brother, Noah Harney, and there's a bounty on his head. she narrates it, like I said, in the first person, and this voice is so critical to the book. You almost kind of took it on there with that kind of deeper tone and that Western twang to it. How did you arrive at that? Did that come to you also when you heard these words?
Yes, all of the elements of the voice that you mentioned were there when I first heard it. I didn't know where the story was going to go. I didn't know even who the protagonist was when I heard those words. I just heard that voice. And the writing process for me was mostly sitting in a dark room by myself, speaking these lines out loud, hearing them in the room about me. And I very much felt like I was transcribing Jess's story for her. She's someone who exists sort of outside of our normal identity boundaries.
Well, she's not a typical Western character. One of the references that came to mind when I read the book, of course, is True Grit, which is narrated by a girl, also on a quest, but she's a girl throughout, and her sexual orientation doesn't really come up. And again, without giving too much away, it does for Jess/Jesse in the book. So there's a lot going on here that's not in your traditional Western.
That's right, yes. And like True Grit, that True Grit is told by an elderly person looking back on their coming of age. And Whiskey When We're Dry has that same setup, and it's a really valuable one because it allows the insights of age to infuse a story about youth. Jesse's story, though, is different, and to me, Jesse is someone who's born as a woman. She does dress as a man, and through the middle of the book, from my perspective, she's pretending to be a man. By the end,
and
of
that's
the,
for pure survival on her part.
For survival, yep. But she's finding that she's actually more comfortable as a man, and to me, she's a character who's transitioning during the book to becoming not a girl, not a man, but something herself. She's becoming, someone who is real to herself and staying true to herself, sort of below these levels of gender identity.
Right.
Yeah.
Certainly a modern concept of gender fluidity there, or certainly right. Sexual orientation fluidity.
But without the language that we are blessed with now.
Right, because this is back in 1885.
Yes. So this is a character who has to make sense of her or his identity without the great tools of the language that we have in the contemporary moment.
Now, the Western is new for you based on your previous works. In reviews I've read for Whiskey When We're Dry, you've been compared to other writers who have written Western. Some literary ones like Larry McMurtry and Cormac McCarthy come to mind. I was wondering the influence they might have had on you, but also we were talking earlier before the interview about my wife's family in Pendleton, and her father was a big fan of Louis L'Amour. And when he died, I got almost all his Louis L'Amour books. So I developed kind of a passion for that genre Western. Of course, there's Zane Grey, Charles Portis, True Grit. Elmore Leonard wrote Westerns before he got into mysteries. What was the influence on previous writers and maybe even movies, John Wayne movies and old Westerns?
Yeah. Well, I grew up reading the very Westerns you mentioned. Louis L'Amour were the first novels that I read. My uncle's farmhouse had 3 versions of the Bible on the bottom shelf and 87 leather-bound Louis L'Amour novels on the top. So, that sort of explained a lot about the significance of Westerns to me, at least to the men that I knew.
Right.
So as a young person, I read Westerns looking for models of masculinity. And as I grew up, I started to sort of doubt those models that I had seen in the Westerns I was reading as a kid. I started to doubt a lot of things that I had seen in the Western. So when I decided to, leave my early career and pursue writing, it was always with the intention of writing a Western that would kind of shatter the dominant Western narrative that we think of when we think of John Wayne, John Ford.
Clint Eastwood, even.
Exactly. Westerns are built on these simple dichotomies between good and evil, men and women, the just and the unjust. They're always dehumanized others. And the early Westerns, like Riders of the Purple Sage, those dehumanized others were Mormons. In later Westerns, they became Native Americans. They became Mexicans. There were always people who were subhuman. and the hero was presented as the just human figure.
Right.
And I wanted to challenge that because I see the same dynamic in our political discourse now more than ever. And I think that it's an intellectual flaw that has been propagated through our stories, and the Western more so than any other genre.
That kind of binary look at the world.
That's right.
Good or evil, zeros or ones.
Yes. And that kind of way of looking at the world I see as growing out of America's, you know, literary tradition of the Western. It is the United States' original literary genre. And it has it plays a really dominant role in our culture that I think we don't even realize now because it's so ingrained. Generations of people reading these Westerns, passing on those models of masculinity to their children who might not read Westerns anymore. But, you know, it's really informed a lot about our country, I believe, the Western has.
So this was something that you were very aware of, kind of the mores of the traditional Western, and these were things you were kind of playing with, maybe transgressing some of those traditional modes.
Yes, and it grew out, you know, for me, this all started in one moment when George W. Bush put on a cowboy hat and a belt buckle and invited the media to his ranch in Texas. You'll remember George W. Bush was born in Connecticut, so he's not a Texan, but he appropriated the Texas swagger, and used it for political gain. But in that moment, when he's wearing the cowboy hat and the belt buckle, leaning against a barbed wire fence, he's talking about the need for an impenetrable border wall between the two countries. And he didn't even realize the irony that he was wearing the appropriated styles of a Mexican laborer, the cowboy hat, the belt buckle, the traditions of the cowboy. Even the word cowboy is a direct translation of a Spanish word. So these traditions come from Mexico. Americans have appropriated them, and somehow we've forgotten that fact, and we think of the cowboy as the quintessential American.
Now, I want to get to an influence on the book from another writer, and you mentioned this in the acknowledgments, actually, Gillian Welch, who's a songwriter. You said her song Tennessee inspired the book and also gave the book its title. I looked that up, and man, it's a beautiful song. It brought tears to my eyes, and very complex lyrics. But the refrain goes, now let me go, my honey-o, back to Tennessee. It's beefsteak when I'm working, whiskey when I'm dry, sweet heaven when I die. I wonder what touched you in Gillian Welch's song.
Not just that song, but all of her songs were a portal for me to get back to this voice. When I would not be able to hear the voice anymore, I'd listen to Gillian Welch's music and just be transported back into this very rough, gritty American vernacular. And Gillian Welch is actually playing with lyrics that come from old Western songs.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so yeah. Tex Ritter is the earliest place that I found where we hear this phrase, whiskey when I'm dry. But in Gillian Welch's hands, or, you know, in her instruments, she brings out this American quality in the voice that really resonates for me.
And yet plays with a tradition. It seems like she's doing in Tennessee what you're doing in Whiskey When It's Dry, the novel a bit, taking the traditions of the form and then playing with them a little and maybe crossing them up a bit.
I would agree, absolutely. And you know, she's in those songs, she taps into these core truths and contradictions about being an American. And very much this book was a daily process of me both celebrating American identity and questioning American identity, sort of dealing with that contradiction. And I think that's something that we're all doing every day. We're all trying to figure out what it means to be an American right now.
Especially now with the kneeling, taking a knee during the national anthem.
That's right.
Is that anti-American or is it actually pro-American?
Exactly.
I know which side I'm on. But
yeah. And, you know, in writing, I know personally what side I'm on. In writing this book, I was always trying to keep a foot on both sides. It's very easy for all of us to be pessimistic and negative, even self-pitying right now. And in this book, I was always trying to make sure that I was writing an optimistic book that was getting at the core elements of the American character and trying to celebrate those elements of the American character.
And it's a book full of just great beauty and compassion, which I think leads me to think it's optimistic. Human nature. There's some evil people in there too, some bad people, but there's a lot of love and compassion too.
Yeah, the people who have power in this book, like some of the people who have power in our contemporary world right now, are really interested in their self-interest. They're not thinking about the country.
And one last question, John. Obviously, I wasn't the only one thinking this would make a great movie. But you sold the film rights and television rights to a production team, and you're now in the process of maybe turning that into a miniseries, a TV series?
That's right. So at the end of August, when Whiskey came out, I went to L.A. and met for a second time with the writers and producers who bought the rights. And we very much share the same vision that we, you know, want to both sort of undermine the tradition of the Western and the elements of the Western that we think are unhealthy, but also celebrate elements of American character that might not have gotten much screen time in the past. And so we're very much on the same page. And when they found out that Whiskey used to be 750 pages, now it's, you know, 380, they decided that instead of doing a feature film, they were going to explore the idea of writing a 10-part limited series that would allow us a lot of time to bring in these other
that you wrote
stories.
But didn't put in the final
that's right.
Manuscript.
That I wrote but that got cut out because, you know, it's hard to have a book that's that long.
Right.
Yeah, it's hard on the reader.
And editors are evil.
My editors have been great. Yeah.
I'm just kidding. They're very necessary.
Absolutely. This book was a mess until my editors came along. Yeah.
Do you have any time estimate on when that will be ready? A year, 2 years? Or I guess it's hard to tell with Hollywood.
It is. It's very hard to tell with Hollywood. And the average amount of time is about 5 years. And there's some reasons to think we might be a little faster than that. And there's also some potential hurdles that may mean that it takes a little longer. So we'll just, you know, have to wait.
Well,
and
I look
see.
Forward to that. I also look forward to the next book by John Larrison.
Thank you.
Well, John, thanks very much for coming into KABU.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Oregon-based writer John Larrison about his new novel, Whiskey When We're Dry, from Viking Press. You can pick up a signed copy at Powell's in Portland or Grassroots Books and Music in Corvallis, and you could meet John at his next reading on Monday, September 24th, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Corvallis Benton Library. That's at 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue in Corvallis. This is Ken Jones for KABU's News in Depth.
It's beefsteak when I'm working, whiskey when I'm dry, sweet hair.